This is the Perth Asian Lawyer Podcast with Raymond Tan. Episode 7, Superfund. The Perth Asian Lawyer Podcast is brought to you by Tan and Tan Lawyers. Find out more about them by visiting www.tanandtanlawyers.com. The advice contained herein does not take into account any person's particular objectives, needs, or financial situation. Before making a decision regarding the acquisition or disposal of a financial product, persons should assess whether the advice is appropriate to their objectives, needs, or financial situation. Persons may wish to make this assessment themselves or seek the help of an advisor. No responsibility is taken for persons acting on the information provided. Persons doing so do so at their own risk.
Hello, everybody. This is Raymond Tan of Tan and Tan Lawyers, and welcome to the first podcast for the year. Today, I have invited a friend of mine who is also my financial planner, Paula Gunham of Clarity Wealth Management, and she has personally helped me through a very interesting period last year when I set up my own self-managed super fund. Now, Paula Gunham is a sub-authorized representative of Gunham Services Corporate Authorized Representative number 338966 of Century Financial Services, AFSL 286786. That's a mouthful, isn't it, Paula?
It is. I'm very sorry, Raymond. The compliments are a bit heavy in my area.
Now, Paula, can you just introduce yourself to my listeners and tell us exactly what you do for a living?
Yeah, sure, Raymond. Well, we provide independent advice to both business and personal clients, and I personally come from a background of corporate financial planning, working in the banking sector, and I had an independent practice in the UK. I spent about 11 years in taxation prior to that, and I've owned a variety of businesses in different countries in between. So as financial planners, we like to look at the bigger picture for clients, and our advice is very much strategy focused.
Well, Paula, you were quite brilliant last year when you steered me through the setup of my own self-managed super fund. Can you tell us, Paula, and our listeners, three good reasons why we should set up such a self-managed super fund?
Well, thanks, Raymond. Well, what's good for one isn't necessarily good for all. However, the three main reasons for clients starting a self-managed super fund are firstly to take control. And by that, I mean control of investments. For instance, you can purchase direct property. Control of death benefits. It can provide certainty, for instance, on divorce. And control of retirement benefits, they can pay a variety of pensions and lump sums, all of which have different estate planning and social security characteristics. Secondly, there's tax effectiveness, for instance, maximising the after-tax return of the fund, and the transfer from accumulation to pension phase in a self-managed super fund doesn't trigger capital gains tax. And thirdly, there's cost savings for the larger funds, as these costs tend to be fixed.
Well, there must be some situation where you would tell your clients that it is not worthwhile to set up a super fund.
Yeah. If somebody has less than, say, $200,000 in super, it probably wouldn't be suitable, as the cost of running a self-managed super fund at that level tends to be higher than using a retail super fund. A lot of the cost for the self-managed super fund is fixed, the cost of the tax return, the audit, the ATO levy, whereas with retail super funds, they charge a percentage of the investment. So there's a break-even point on costs, and that usually comes in around $200,000. A self-managed super fund becomes substantially cheaper to run for the larger super funds when compared with a retail fund. Also, for some clients, they simply don't want to take control of the super or to take on the obligations of the trustees, the compliance issues. They're actually quite happy with retail super, so it's not for everybody. But for clients who do want control, they don't want to purchase a direct property but don't have the time or the expertise to manage it properly, a self-managed super fund administration service picks up the difference, and that's quite invaluable, as a lot of the administrative and compliance tasks are completed for them. So they're halfway houses as well.
Well, just off the record, what happens, or have you ever had clients who have lost control of their self-managed super fund, and are they attacked by the ATO?
Well, that can happen if it becomes non-compliant. You don't even want to contemplate it because you could potentially lose half of your self-managed super fund. And that's just not, you know, that's the entire fund, not just a little bit that might be uncompliant. So it can be around making sure that your investment strategy is in place and relevant to the assets you've got. Lots of self-managed super funds out there don't even have an investment strategy. And, you know, it is quite a complex area, and there are 101 things that can go wrong. An incredibly effective vehicle if it's used properly, but if not, we don't even want to contemplate getting it wrong.
There is a lot of talk about using a self-managed super fund to borrow money for investments. I personally have entered into an installment warrant arrangement to sell my office to my own super fund, with your assistance, of course. Can you tell our listeners how this actually works?
Yeah, Raymond. Well, this is still relatively new. Super's been through many changes over the last couple of years. And in 2007, the government allowed borrowing under limited recourse arrangements. So to set it up for existing funds, you must update the self-managed super fund trust deed to ensure it allows borrowing. You can't just go out and assume you can already do it, because the change only came in 2007. And secondly, to protect the existing assets in the fund and to provide a degree of separation while gearing, a second entity is established. This is called a Bear Trust, also known as a custodian trust. And this holds the assets of the self-managed super fund while the borrowing is in place. And then finally, a limited recourse loan is established to provide the funding. And this means that the lender only has recourse to the assets that it's lending against. It can't touch any of the self-managed super fund assets. And the installment warrant documentation basically underpins the whole arrangement. So the process is fairly complex in that every case presents different challenges. But I can't stress how important it is to have all your ducks in a row, all your paperwork done, before you start putting an office on property. The paperwork and structure have to be 100% correct, as the penalties are just too high to get this wrong. But the opportunities that gearing presents are quite huge. And prior to this, only shares could be purchased under an instalment warrant arrangement through gearing. And really, even this was unknown. Yeah, it's very rarely used.
Well, I've personally had clients who have been whacked with double stamped duty because they didn't get their paperwork done properly. Now, but what are the benefits of using such a method to purchase properties, Paula?
Well, compared with holding it in your own name, the benefits are quite numerous, but so are the different strategies available. Everyone's quite unique and presents differently. But one, for instance, would be in the case of a commercial property that's used by a client's own business. So this would create a very tax-efficient environment to have that property within a self-managed super fund. You see, in accumulation phase, super has a maximum tax rate of 15%, and the loan interest payments are tax-deductible to the self-managed super fund, which helps reduce this rate even further. So there's at least 85 cents in every dollar available to pay that loan down. Well, compare that with somebody paying a personal top rate of 45%. Leaving less than 55% in the dollar after Medicare levies, etc., to pay that loan down. So you can ship that loan a lot quicker. And furthermore, in the case of using the property for your own business, the business is paying rental income to your own self-managed super fund. Well, the rental incomes are tax deductible to the business. So it's a very tax-efficient strategy. Also, without gearing, one of the problems with buying property in a self-managed super fund can be the lack of liquidity if a property is bought outright. So it's a very lumpy asset to hold. So by gearing, it allows more of the fund's assets to be invested in a variety of asset classes to help out liquidity and diversification, rather than using all of your funds to buy one property outright. However, the gearing ratios should be such that it's a set and forget strategy. You don't want to be having to worry about your super, and the loan payments paid by the rental income and the income from other assets should take care of the loan payments. So you shouldn't have to be thinking about it. But a further advantage under the current super rules is that after age 60, when in pension phase, so when you're taking an income, it becomes a tax-free environment. So an asset can be sold down capital gains tax-free, or the rental income paid out as a tax-free pension. This is under today's legislation. But even if the asset is sold prior to 60, if the asset's been held for more than 12 months, capital gains tax is around about 10% in the super environment, so it's still very tax efficient.
That sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
Very too good to be true. Well, we are seen as a bit of a tax haven in other countries. They can't believe it. In England, where you get tax relief up front, your pension is taxed. Over here, it's tax-free, yeah. So,
is there a downside to that?
Well, the downside, of course, is that the capital is held within super, and it's locked away until you meet what's called a condition of release. for instance, retirement after preservation age, which is currently between 55 and 60 years old. But people of 55 can access the income from super under the new transition to retirement legislation, which leads to some interesting strategies as well. But there are a few different ways of getting assets and properties into self-managed super funds which don't always involve borrowing. For instance, moving existing assets into super in what's called in specie as part of non-conceptional or voluntary contributions, and that strategy is underutilized.
Well, so far you seem to be very much persuading me, or I suppose you've really persuaded me that going into a self-managed super fund is the way to go. But there must, what do you believe the trustees should be wary of if they go into such an arrangement?
Yeah, and there are the pitfalls. As you say, you've got to get your paperwork right. You can have double stamp duty, or you can be charged stamp duty, or you can claim an exemption if you get it right. Double capital gains tax later on if you get it wrong. So, basically, self-managed super funds are regulated by the ATO, whereas retail super is regulated by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, what a mouthful, APRA. Under the ATO, the trustee's responsibilities for a self-managed super fund are many, which is why lots of people like to outsource the compliance part. The self-managed super fund deed binds the trustees to follow the rules, and any breach could cause the trustees to be penalised or disqualified, or cause the fund to become non-compliant, as we said, and lose its concessional tax treatment. But problems that specifically relate to property purchase can be anything from ensuring that the transactions are made at what's called an arm's length basis, or if gearing, you've got to consider how to clear the debt in the event of a member dying. The contributions you make to super are capped, so if a member were to die, it could be difficult getting sufficient funds into the super to pay down the loan, even if somebody did have the funds outside to put in. But there are solutions to some of these problems. But each needs thinking through and addressing, so it's not something you enter into lightly. You need careful planning.
Well, which reminds me, you better remind me about this insurance that I have to look into.
Absolutely.
Well, so far we've been focusing on using the self-managed super fund strategy for tax savings. But I suppose the readers want to know, what actually happens when the super fund has to be accessed by the beneficiaries?
Yeah, good question. But this depends who the beneficiaries are, of course. Within the self-managed, where the self-managed super fund contains a property, for example, and the death benefit is left to a spouse, a pension can be paid, so you're not having to sell down assets within the fund. However, with non-dependent children, so this would be like adult children, they can only receive a lump sum. So where there's property in the self-managed super fund, this can cause problems, as the property would generally need to be sold to pay out a lump sum. So it's particularly tricky where the property has been used by the business, but there are solutions to that again. And there are many self-managed super fund strategies that can actually help with estate planning. For instance, children can become members of the fund, because you can have up to four members in total, and the life insurance proceeds can be paid into what's called a reserve account if you've got insurance through your self-managed super fund. And these payments from the reserve account can be added to the children's accounts, their own super accounts annually, as concessional contributions to super. So the self-managed super fund can continue for the next generation even after your death. And the reserve accounts are quite an interesting, there's lots of strategies around them, again, an underutilized part. But a word of caution note, you should never make just one child a member or trustee of the fund, because there was a case in 2007, Katz versus Grossman, where a couple were individual trustees of their own self-managed super fund. And the mother unfortunately died, and the father appointed his daughter as a second trustee. The father also subsequently died, and he had made one binding nomination, directing that his death benefits be shared equally between his son and his daughter. However, the daughter is a surviving trustee. She appointed her husband as the other trustee, which is one of her powers. As a trustee, she's able to appoint further trustees. And the new trustees together paid the entire death benefit to the daughter, making no payment to the son whatsoever. Well, the assets exceeded $1 million. And the son fought the decision in court on the basis that the appointments of his sister and her husband as trustees were invalid. But he lost the case and actually received no benefit from the self-managed super fund, because they always go back to the original trustees and the power of the trustees. So you do have to be careful.
Well, I suppose it's a classic story of not getting legal advice as to how they appoint the trustees and not preparing a will that covers everything. Well, Spoiler, can you tell us who usually is entitled to receive a death benefit, or how do they make sure that they are entitled?
Yeah, under the Superannuation Industry Supervision Act, another mouthful, let's call it SIS, a dependent, the deceased legal representative, and in limited circumstances, a non-dependent can receive the death benefit. So basically, the SIF Act defines a dependent as a spouse, including de facto, or a former spouse, or any child of the member under age 18, a stepchild, ex-nuptial or adopted child, or any person with whom the member had an interdependency relationship. But the trustee should allow pension to be paid, but this can only be paid to spouses, dependent children, and non-child, what they call interdependents. Everybody else has to have a lump sum. But you also need to know that now SIF is tax-free when in pension phase for the over 60s. SIF paid to beneficiaries loses its tax-free status. So while a surviving spouse can receive an income stream for the death benefit, if they're set up as a reversionary beneficiary, sorry, throwing all this jargon at you here, where a beneficiary is, say, an adult child, then there will be tax consequences. But there are strategies we can do to help minimise this, such as recontribution strategies. So you would take a tax-free lump sum from the super while the member's still alive, and then subsequently recontribute it to superannuation, contributing it as an untaxed contribution. So it's just recycling, but it's just making sure that you're minimising the tax payable on the death benefit for the non-dependents who always think on for the next generation. It can be a technical subject, unfortunately, this one.
I assume that would be something that you would discuss with your accountants before you do anything else.
Absolutely. You know, having your accountants there to guide you, your financial planner, you need to, dip into all your advisors.
Well, is there any way to challenge the way a trustee distributes the benefit?
Well, there is. That's with a will. The payment of a member's death benefit can be challenged. And the Self-Managed Super Fund is quite interesting. They hold discretionary powers. There's a mere power and a trust power. And a mere power is a discretion that the trustee may exercise. And the trust power is one that the trustee must exercise. And the payment of death benefits is a trust power. But the trustee still has discretion as to whom the benefit is paid and in what proportions. But this must be consistent with the Superannuation Industry Supervision Act that we mentioned previously. The trustee contains the rules around how the trustee deals with superannuation entitlements and the death of a member, so it covers binding nominations and payment of death benefits in forms of pensions. And most trustees allow the trustee ultimate discretion how the member's death benefit is paid. But the SIS limits the potential recipients of such benefits, and in most cases the trustee will follow the member's nomination, except where it's in breach of the SIS rules or is inappropriate or contentious. So it's really important to make sure that there's consistency between the will and the binding nomination to the super trustee, especially where a member's circumstances are more complicated, people are remarried or even same-sex couples. I did have a client who had a binding nomination in place of his ex-wife, and he was living in a de facto relationship with somebody else. This is an ordinary super. It was an acrimonious divorce, and the last thing he would have wanted was for the payment to go to his previous wife. It was just something he'd overlooked. So likewise, a full review of life insurance arrangements, a new will, it all needs to be carried out following a divorce as well.
Well, it's always the case, right? Everything goes when there's a divorce. But Paula, I also acted for a client once to challenge the distribution of the super fund by going to the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal. Do you do the same thing if you want to challenge a self-managed super fund?
It's slightly different because self-managed super funds aren't subject to the jurisdiction of the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal, as this is only available to the members of APRA-related super funds. So, you know, your general resale super funds. So potential beneficiaries can't use this avenue to challenge any death benefit payments by fund trustees. So they need to go through the court, which may be an expensive process, as you well know. So, yeah, they do need to be careful.
Well, Paula, you have certainly enlightened us today regarding some very topical issues regarding superannuation and self-managed super funds. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to catch up again and talk about some other interesting superannuation issues. Thanks very much for speaking to us tonight, Paula.
Thanks. Good night. Take care.